Welcome, welcome to Freaked Out with your co-host, Liz and Landon.
What's up, everybody?
Today, we were actually planning to cover the story of Amy Todd Fleming. However, we were having a hard time connecting, and we decided that we were going to cover another case because, you know, it just wasn't working out. Luckily for us, we have many, many, many other cases that we were planning to focus on. So I'm sure we'll come back to Amy at some point. I just didn't feel like there was enough information to make a whole episode. Anyways, maybe you'll see something on TikTok about it instead.
Yeah, you know, and we decided that we were going to do a case that was a little bit on the older side, and it's been outstanding for quite some time. So let's get this going and head back to 1981.
A lot of things happened in 1981. Ronald Reagan was the 40th president of the United States. The AIDS virus was first identified, and the case of HIV and AIDS began in the USA at this point.
Crazy. Now, the Post-it note was also invented and launched, and NASA launched the space shuttle Columbia, Dukes of Hazzard, Star Wars. All those were pretty popular movies, toys, dolls, all beginning in 1981.
And velvet, velour, polyester were very popular fabrics back then. And looser pants, tight shirts were also pretty popular.
Not gonna lie, velour, polyester was very nice feeling. Now, here's the part that, you know, I wish that we could go back to. The average cost of a new home was only $78,000. Like, I can't even get a house now for under $3 million. And the monthly amount of rent was only $315. You can't even rent anything for under $3,000 nowadays.
Right. I would love for us to follow within the footsteps of the dollar back in 1981. Today we'd be so rich if we did. We'd also be able to spend more money on things rather than just bills and groceries and rent.
Absolutely, we'd be able to actually live, but that's a problem. They don't want us to live. They want us to just get no freedom. Now, enough about the 80s for right now. Let's talk about Cynthia Jane Anderson. We're going to call her Cindy because that's what she went by.
Absolutely. Now, Cindy was last seen on August 4th, 1981, and she was working at a law office in Toledo, Ohio. She was only 20 years old at the time she went missing. Her car was parked outside, and also a book was open on her desk, and she was nowhere to be found.
Now, when the law partners had arrived back to the office after meeting at noon to find the radio on their desk and their desks were prepared for the day, Cindy left her romance novel open on her desk to the only violent scene in the book where the heroine was abducted at knife point.
There was no signs of her anywhere in the building, and there was no signs of struggle or anything along those lines.
Also, her purse and keys were missing, but her car was locked in the parking lot right outside of the office. She always kept the doors to the office locked, though. A buzzer has been installed at her desk to alert the shop next door in case of any trouble. This was due to strange and harassing phone calls that she had been personally receiving.
She was also seen wearing a white V-neck dress with pink pinstripes, a cinnamon brown pantyhose color, and beige open-toe ankle strap sandals. She also had a chickenpox scar on her forehead and 1.5-inch scar on her right knee that was in the shape of a fish hook.
Now, let's go back and talk about this particular day so that we can, you know, put these pieces together. Now, Cindy was preparing her life for a new chapter, which we will get into a little bit later.
Now, from what I gather, she was running a bit behind that day for work. It seems as though she didn't make it to work until about 9:45. I can see her. She was very frustrated about what was going on in her life at the moment. And I also see she was having a hard time with her family, more so her father than anyone else. She was extremely frustrated by being late and was not happy about it at all. Calls that were supposed to be answered in the law office at 10 a.m. went completely unanswered.
Now, her coworkers came to work quite a bit later. From what we gather, they didn't show up until approximately around noon. But it could have been many different reasons. You know, they could have been in court. They could have been doing, you know, whatever, having a meeting or what they needed to do from the previous day. But from the looks of it, they just didn't show up until way later.
And this is the part that is stumping everyone. Now, when they arrived, they found no one. Cindy had taken her purse and her keys, but her white 1980 Chevrolet Citation remained parked outside. There was no note left. The air conditioner, radio, lights were still on. It's as if she was just plucked out of the office with no leads anywhere.
Now let's talk about Cindy's history growing up. She was 20 years old at the time. She was living with her family. She had been raised in a very religious household, and they were of the Christian fundamentalists.
Now, women are to play the role of the caregiver and the helper, and they are not allowed to hold any sort of position of authority because women in this religion are supposed to be more subservient to men.
Now, many fundamentalists do not smoke, they don't drink alcohol, they don't dance or even attend anything like movies or plays. And most fundamental schools and institutions, these are very strict practices and they are forbidden.
Oh yeah. Now, from what I gather from Cindy directly, she was not interested in what her father wanted for her specifically. She also had a boyfriend from the exact same church, which, in my opinion, men were more interested in the religion because they would be considered the dominant, you know, because they get to be the one that gets to be treated like a king. So, of course, he had no issues with that.
I mean, of course, that's basically what religion is empowering men and never anyone else. Now, when trying to search for, you know, his name, the only thing that came up was Jim Rabbit, which is a very odd thing because one of her boss's name was Jim Rabbit. Not really sure why, you know, they're combining those two names. But either way, it doesn't look like there was any names for her boyfriend at all at the time.
Yeah, I can tell you this part of it. Basically, this man was like handpicked by the father to be the love of her life. And from what she shows me, he gave her the major icks. She shows me that he was very selfish. And although she enjoyed being able to get out of the house every once in a while with him, she knew that he was not the man she wanted to be with. But she also knew that they were going to end up going to school together, and they were going to be getting most likely married. She shows me that in her mindset, he was lesser of the two evils, and really anything to get away from her father.
Now, her father was pretty strict. Even after she went missing, he basically blamed her for going missing because of what she was wearing. Because she was wearing makeup and, you know, maybe something that he just didn't want her to wear. So he said that she put herself out there.
Oh, yeah. He blamed her for a lot of things. But we're going to get back into that in a little while here when it comes to Cindy directly.
Now, her father's name is Michael Anderson, and he describes his daughter as quiet and obedient, and she was a girl that never made waves and had a lot of friends, which is probably the nicest thing that he will say about her.
Oh, yeah, and I get this gut-wrenching feeling in my stomach when I think about him. I can feel his energy even now. Ugh.
Yeah, now while researching the situation, her father said that Cindy had been spending a lot of time on her face and becoming more of a debutante. He also said that her neighbors described her as an attractive young woman who may have caught the attention of a passerby.
What a wonderful dad. I know that Cindy had many, many family members, including her sisters and mother, but he's the only one to speak up on this situation because it looks like he knows her oh so well.
Or it's because he's controlling and he's the only one who should be speaking on this. And no one else is allowed to. That sounds more like it. Now, she, of course, lived with her parents at home, as we stated before. And they had a very strict rules and curfews. Even though Cindy was 20, they still expected her to follow all of these rules in the home.
Oh, yeah. And the law office in Toledo belonging to James Rabbit and Jay Feldston. She did seem to like her job, but definitely was on the verge of quitting for her schooling. She was only 2 weeks away from starting her Bible college with her boyfriend.
Ooh, yay, so fun, Bible college. Jumping for joy. Now, according to Cindy's sister, Christine, she was having a lot of strange things taking place, including having dreams about someone she was interested in knocking on her door.
Obviously, this means that she had some sort of ability, in my opinion. It's sad because all these things were transpiring and these reoccurring dreams continue to keep on coming, warning her of bad things, you know? And from what she shows me, she had no idea how to stop it. She also chalked it up to being part of her books. She would often read books to hide from her own reality, and she would read them as she was going to bed, and she really liked romance novels and also horror.
Now, in addition to her very unusual reoccurring dreams, a number of other strange things began to happen to Cindy in the days and weeks and months leading up to her disappearance. Cindy often felt as though she was being watched. There was also something very unusual that took place across from her office. There was a wall, and somebody painted something that said, "I love you, Cindy," in large letters, along with smaller letters saying from GW. According to one of her friends, Cindy was the only person with that name that worked right on that strip mall where the law office was located, that this sign had seemed to intentionally be positioned so that Cindy would have to see it all the time.
Yeah, everyone, including Cindy, was racking their brains to figure out who GW is. And this particular sign had stayed on the wall for 6 months before they finally began painting over it. And just a few short months later, the message reappeared, and this time the letters were larger.
Holy smokes. Now, she then started to receive phone calls. They were leaving disturbing and ominous messages. And one of the law firm clients, Larry Mullins, actually witnessed this. He had recalled a time when Cindy answered while he was in the office and said that she picked up the phone very quickly and then hung it right back up. And then soon after, the phone had began to ring again.
According to Mr. Mullins, she looked scared of whoever was calling her. She often felt like she was going to be kidnapped or murdered, and I believe she shared this information with her family members and more so her sisters and mom than anyone else.
Now, everyone at her job was extremely concerned for her well-being and her being paranoid, which is, I mean, obviously understandable with all these creepy things happening. So her employers instructed her to keep the office doors locked at all times, even during the business hours. And they even installed that emergency buzzer at the desk, which would alert any nearby businesses if she were in any sort of unfortunate predicaments.
I did also want to mention a couple of things in relation to her timeline. So it was a Tuesday, and she had skipped breakfast, left the house at approximately 8:30, but didn't arrive until 9:45, right? Kind of weird.
I mean, sounds like, you know, she was skipping breakfast because she was running late.
Right. Even when the lawyer arrived at the office, they could smell the scent of fresh nail polish and nail polish remover in the air.
And Cindy was really good at leaving notes if she did have to go somewhere, which also makes me believe that if somebody was able to get into that office and abduct her, they had to have, you know, known her personally, or, you know, she wouldn't have opened that door.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of conspiracies out there in relation to this case. And if you do want to go and do a deeper dive on the conspiracies, you're definitely welcome to do so. We'll give you guys a little bit of information on it, but not too much, and do it.
Absolutely. Now, also, we want to point out that her romance novel was left there very oddly. It was almost, you know, very eerie as well, because it was open to a page that described somebody who was being abducted at knife point, like we had said previously. And a lot of officers thought that that was just a message that was left by whoever took her, which is a big possibility. Why would it be on that page, you know?
Right. People think that it could have potentially been the person that was stalking her that had kidnapped her, right? People also think that it could have been her father. Also, people are thinking it could have been something in relation to something drug related, because somebody at her work, she may have had some sort of involvement in overhearing something drug related.
Now, I don't really agree with this job being the one that hurt her, because they were really trying to help her through this very stressful time in her life. And then all of a sudden, just to kill her or kidnap her doesn't make any sense.
She also had a large sum of money in her bank account, and people are thinking that she may have just run away from her life because of what was about to happen in 2 weeks.
I mean, I would. Now, it definitely makes more sense for that. It makes more sense for the law office with her being connected to her maybe potentially hearing about some sort of drug stuff going on.
Oh, yeah. Another possibility is that it could have been someone that worked in the building. The detectives were able to connect a named GW to someone who worked in the building who had keys, who could have easily had access to her office.
I mean, that makes sense. You know, has a lot of time to watch her, stare at her. They worked in the building, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a short while after Cindy's disappearance, the police received a phone call, and it was a woman's voice whispering on the line, insisting that she remain anonymous. And she did reveal while whispering that Cindy could be found in the basement of a white house, one of two houses standing right next to the other, owned by a single family, before very quickly hanging up, and there was no other information.
This case is so unusual, I just don't even understand. Why the fuck someone would randomly call in a whisper, you know, like, it makes no sense to me.
Pretty much, and just being like, she's in a basement of one of the white houses that stand next to the two white houses. Like, what the fuck?
The vibe I get from that situation is that she did not like her neighbors, and she just assumed that her neighbors were doing something bad.
Most likely. Now, when it comes to the information surrounding this drug-related situation in 1981, was Richard Neller, and one of Neller's clients was Jose Rodriguez Jr. In 1996, Neller and Rodriguez were both convicted for involvement in a longtime drug conspiracy, so the attorney and the client were both convicted, and Cindy could have maybe overheard Neller and Rodriguez discussing something about these drug deals.
There was also, like, serial killer brothers that were killing people, and they said that they did not kill Cindy.
Now, this case is really driving us crazy because we've been wanting to know this information since we have started it.
Now, there's a lot Cindy wants to talk about, and she wants to talk about the stuff at home first, so that's where we're going to go. She says it's extremely important to this case.
Well, then I guess that'll be our first question. What took place at home that she would like to share with us?
I got the feeling from the very beginning, so I'm glad she kind of explained it to me in a bigger way. Now, from what Cindy shows me, she was a very obedient child. Unlike her other siblings, she was more obedient throughout the years. However, she started to become a little bit less obedient as she got older, climbing in and around the age of 18. That is when she started to have her own little rebellion. She shows me she was sexually assaulted by one of the people in her church. She also shows me her father had also sexually assaulted her. Now, I know that's a lot of heavy information right off the top, but she did have to share it. She also shows me that the boyfriend was also incredibly sexual towards her, and because he was her boyfriend, she would just, you know, have to be submissive. And because of that, she was submissive with him as well. She shows me she took the brunt of that. She shows me that when it comes to the sexual assaulting from her father's standpoint, she decided to just allow him to do it so that her sisters did not have to deal with this on their end either.
I mean, that's a very noble thing of her to do, to, you know, try to protect her sisters from that. But I definitely see also, like, in my opinion now, I'm starting to think she just ran away because fuck this life.
Well, she shows me that this was all before she found makeup and started wearing things a little bit more on the seductive side, at least from her father's perspective. But in reality, was just wearing things like, you know, off the shoulder, showing her collar, not wearing pantyhose or whatever the case may be. She shows me it was extremely modest in comparison to what's going on in the world now. She shows me she was constantly fighting with her father about everything. And basically, he would call her a slut constantly.
Now, what the hell should we call him? A douche canoe? Now, she wasn't even dressing poorly from my perspective. I mean, ooh, she wasn't wearing pantyhose. Ooh, big whoop. This was the 80s, you know? So why did he end up raping her?
She shows me that also was her fault for just being too gorgeous and too much of a temptation, even with her disturbingly modest clothing. He would rape her and tell her that she's getting raped for being a temptation, and in her mind, putting on makeup and dressing a little bit more provocative, in air quotations, was more of, you know, her taking control of her own life, perhaps making her father hate her a little bit more.
Yeah, when you're, like, so controlled in these, you know, controlling environments, like doing, you know, like a little makeup or changing your hair or changing your clothing, that gives you a sense of empowerment, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you there. What she didn't realize is that she was going to get more punishments in the sense of being raped by her father. This particular morning, she shows me that she had just been sexually assaulted the night before by her dad. She also shows me that he had told her it was based upon her appearance. She decided she wasn't going to take it anymore. She shows me she threatened to tell everyone what he was doing to her, and she wasn't going to take it anymore. She didn't want to go to church. She didn't want to go to church school. She didn't want to go with her boyfriend. She had had enough, and she was basically letting everybody know that she was fucking done. She did, however, want to get away. And from what she's telling me, she was excited about going to school for just the purpose of getting away. But I think she was planning just to go so that she could end up finding her own life and walking away from it all. And that's basically why she was saving all her money. And unfortunately, her father heard all of this other than the escaping school part, and he snapped.
So what did he do?
He started to take particular interest in the novel she was reading. She had left it at home. She wasn't allowed to read novels that weren't Bible related. He decided in that moment he was going to hurt her, like, or try to hurt her, take her out if he could. He was pissed off. He was going to teach her a bigger lesson than he ever had. And he was also worried that he was going to get in trouble or the cops were going to come and do something. She shows me that instead of going back to work for the day, he decided to follow her to her work. And I'm not exactly sure what transpired between the time she had left home to go to work. She might have stopped to get something to eat since she missed some food, or just picking up some food. It could have been like a small diner or something along those lines, maybe even McDonald's. She shows me that she had already felt like someone had been following her for such a long time that she felt like him following her was very normal, because honestly, she didn't know any better. She just always felt like somebody was following her one way or another, but she didn't notice her father driving along behind her because she was too upset and pissed off and just basically trying to keep it together while driving to work.
So he followed her all the way to work, and what happened when they got there?
From what I can see, he did follow her all the way to her job, and he waited until she was settled into her job for about 10 minutes. He decided to go into the law office and tell her he was having an emergent situation. I believe he was faking some sort of health-related issue, mostly in relation to his heart. Now, since she worked in the law office, he was convinced that she was going to run and tell the lawyers that this had taken place. Now, luckily, he noticed that nobody else was around, and he was really afraid that he was going to go to jail, so he just built up this scenario in his mind. When he got into the office, he decided to confront her about her indiscretions, aka reading these books. She told him she was reading them because she was more interested in the horror side of things, and she did love, and that had nothing to do with anything else. However, he told her she was forbidden to do so.
Did he bring the book with him?
He certainly did, and he was the one who pinpointed the exact page where they were being held at knife point and said to her that this is what she wanted. He could help her out. She shows me she was extremely confused by him and believed that she had just painted her nails at this point too. I think she had like a very pale pink on, but from what she shows me, she was wearing red nails, which was like a big no-no for him.
I mean, yeah, red being the color of the devil.
Pretty much. She also had bright red lipstick on from what she shows me as well. And that is when he decided to pull out his own knife. He held it up to her neck. I think he did have something over her mouth. Now, outside, nobody had seen this, by the way. She begged him to stop, but he said no. He told her to close the office up and they were going for a little ride. She told him that her boss would be there shortly and she would have to work and that she would just see him later, but he insisted she was going with him no matter what she said. She shows me she knew that this was very different and unlike other times where he would just rape her. She felt like he was going to hurt her. And funny enough, in her dreams, she would often see members like her dad being the one to hurt her. Although she may not necessarily have shared that information, maybe even had lied about who actually had hurt her in her dreams, but dad was definitely part of it.
So what happened with this guy? Like, what did he, you know, do with her?
I believe he decided to go back to work. I can see that he put her in his trunk. Even walking back to his vehicle, he held the knife behind her and told her, like, if you scream, I'm going to stab you. So she was a good girl and just kind of hopped in the back of his trunk. And I do see that he had tape over her mouth. He even may have had tape over her hands as well and feet, and just threw her in there like she was just nothing.
Well, you know, that's right. You know, he's got to make that alibi real strong, you know?
Precisely. She shows me she was there all day. She also shows me that she couldn't breathe. She shows me that this trunk was old, had no way of, like, getting out of it, no holes. Again, just consistently showing me suffocation. She shows me that her father was stupid, though, and he didn't know that this was going to happen. He thought that she would be fine in there, like, okay. More so just like a punishment, more so like, you know, back in the day when he would punish her. She shows me she often got beat. So he decided at that moment, well, if she wasn't such a debutante, this wouldn't have happened. And that's that attitude to kind of like make him feel better about what he did.
How was he going to explain all of this to his family? Like, what did he do with her body?
God, from what I gather, he was just going to suggest that she had, you know, gone home sick, tell her bosses she had gone home sick. She had, you know, apologized for leaving abruptly. Like, that was his plan, that he was going to hurt her, put her in a room, and then make her call her boss and say, oh shit, I'm sorry, I wasn't feeling well. However, because of everything else that transpired and her accidental death, they had some sort of maybe extension or shed where they had like a lot of the equipment, like the lawnmower, and he basically decapitated her, cut her up in smaller limbs and sorted through the garbage and just kind of threw her away so that no one would ever find her.
So like, did her family know of this or find out?
I don't feel like the kids, you know, saw anything. I feel like mom knew something. Perhaps maybe she didn't know the extent of it, but she knew that something was going on because he was acting out of sorts more than normal. But then she also like chalked it up to being because of Cindy disappearing. So she, you know, put those thoughts away. But something inside of her made her feel like something here is not right. Cindy shows me that her mother would often tell Cindy to behave so that none of these things would happen. I do believe that mom also knew that she was being raped and couldn't do anything about it because that's the fundamental way.
Well, that is very interesting. That doesn't really explain anything, you know, in relation to her stalker, though. Can we talk about that a little bit? Like, what was with the lady on the phone? Like, do we know who that was?
Cindy was extremely generous, and she did have a stalker, and I do believe that the stalker was, in fact, the man that worked in the building. He would, like you said, see her day in and day out, hoping and praying she would notice him. And I feel like he had photos of her walking from her car to the building, building back to her car, following her. So she had, you know, this stalker, an obsessive man. And, you know, obviously, if her father didn't hurt her, I'm pretty sure this guy would have gotten her eventually. When it comes to the phone calls she was receiving, I believe it was also, again, GW contacting her from another part of the building because he knew her direct line and was hoping that one day she would just talk to him.
All right, creep ass. Couldn't, you know, send her flowers and, you know,
communicate normally.
Like, come talk to her face to face. But, you know, honestly, she may have been better off with the stalker. Honestly, I mean, he probably loved her so much he wasn't going to hurt her.
Or at least, you know,
or at least kill her.
I agree with you. I feel as though this person was fucking nuts, but I feel like her father was even nuttier. I also feel like she did get a lot of male attention. She shows me that although her father took away her life, she shows me she always felt like she was going to not be around. she shows me that she had pretty significant dreams, you know, even more so than the ones of hurting her. And of course, she was very intrigued by like romance and horror and true crime stuff. She also shows me that this was not the only life in her life where she tragically died. It was almost like it was destined for this to happen twice.
Now, did her boyfriend seem to care at all about her disappearance, or was he too into himself?
From what she shows me, he moved on real quick to someone else, also connected to his Bible school, and the two of them married very quickly. She also shows me that he's a big-time alcoholic, or at least he was. I'm not sure if he's still around or not. She also shows me that he was very unhappy with his life. He was also really, really looking forward to, you know, being married to Cindy, aka, you know, controlling her. She does feel like she was there, like her life was there to really protect her sisters from, you know, receiving some sort of abuse because she was the one who received the brunt of it. Although the kids did get beaten and weird, you know, things this guy would make them do. Like, I keep seeing grates and things that he would put their feet under, like just crazy fucking shit. But she was able to at least prevent it from the bigger aspect.
Now, did she ever actually know anything or hear anything about this drug-related scandal that was going on at her work?
She did not. She learned very quickly how to ignore conversations between the men. She shows me she never engaged in any capacity. And basically, she was hired to kind of make people happy. There were a lot of people in and out of that office, and they were very sweet to her. May have even offered her a position of being their girlfriend from time to time. She shows me that she would often get hit on all the time. And these men would often, you know, do things like pinch her butt or talk about her breasts. Sometimes she was violated, but she also felt like it was just part of her job. Poor girl most likely would have had like this big major breakdown if she had lived on, you know?
Most likely. Now, I hope her father is definitely rotting in hell.
I'm not sure. She shows me she's had zero contact with him, but I feel like he's lurking. Like, it's just this vibe about him. I know that he passed away. She shows me that he did have a tough life because he did have some sort of remorse. Can you believe it? After she passed on, but he kept it hidden within. She shows me that he became more abusive towards her mother. He also dabbled in drinking, although he wasn't allowed to. He decided to do it because he needed something to mask the memories that kept floating about in his brain. She shows me he did get haunted quite a bit with her memories, and she loved every second of it.
Well, that's great news. I'm glad that she's happy about that. Well, I do want to thank you guys for joining us today. Happy Easter. Hope everyone's enjoying their Easter. This was definitely a wild case. Now, next week, we are going to be covering the Illuminati, or as we call it on TikTok, the Eye, part two, which, in my opinion, is coming at a fantastic time since we have all these things coming out with the Illuminati and some of the people that are involved in there. Now, we definitely can't wait to continue to keep sharing all the things that we get with this particular organization. Now, for those of you that are not patrons, please come and become a patron so that you can listen to these episodes. Also, we are going to be doing the Idaho 4 in just a few weeks, and also all the other exclusive content that we have for you guys. You're not going to want to miss it out. Now, until next time, guys, stay freaked out.